Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Men's Monday here on Mind Talk, which is your daily resource for relationship and mental health information. Today's guest talks to us about family structures that are a little different from the Leave It to Beaver structure that many folks have grown up with. I am very pleased to introduce you to Dr. Joshua Gamson, who is a professor of psychology at the University of San Francisco, and he lives close by with his husband and two daughters. He's also the author of many articles on social movements, sexualities, and popular culture. Professor Gamson, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thanks so much for having me.
I have to ask you about this book. Now, the title of your book is Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. One of the first things that I noticed about it is that the foreword was written by someone who's a pretty well-known and well-respected, Melissa Harris Perry. Why is she in this book about modern families and extraordinary journeys to kinship?
Melissa Harris Perry actually had her most recent child through a surrogate, and she had written about that. And when I was thinking about, you know, who are people that would be interested in the storytelling that I'm doing here in this book, people who have a policy interest in addition to a personal interest, She came to mind, and I contacted her, and she was very supportive and really liked what I was up to, and that led to the foreword. But she had a personal experience to bring to bear, as she writes about in the foreword to the book.
So she, too, is part of sort of this whole fabric of modern families that you talk about in your book.
Absolutely. And what's interesting when you read her foreword, which I love, it's brief and beautiful, is that she started out with a much more conventional story where she got married, her college sweetheart, had a baby, etc. And then later in life, when things sort of, I don't know how she'd put it, but things sort of fell apart and she was restarting a new family, she was in this world of unconventional family making. So she's lived in both worlds. Not all of us in the book have that experience. We all, I think, grew up in more conventional family structures, but we didn't.
Can always tell when I'm talking to a professor.
Why is that?
Because you
be precise.
Absolutely.
Yes, I try to.
Let's talk about your personal story, because there's a reason why you chose to write this book. There's a reason why you reached out to her. What is your personal story?
Yeah, it's a very personal book for someone who is not used to a personal revelation in this kind of way. It began really when we had our first baby, and we, as me and my husband, Richard, we were planning a baby through surrogacy, and it was a very elaborate plan, and it wound up being a very elaborate situation where my college girlfriend carried the baby. We had eggs from a person close to us that we don't name, and sperm from one of us who we also don't name, and we all gathered, and including Tamar is the name of the woman that carried our first child, Reba. We all gathered together at my parents' place in Massachusetts, including her husband. So it was quite a scene. And when it was all finished, I thought, I really need to write this down for posterity, for the baby, for us, because it's, it's so much more than the origin story that I'm used to for, my own life, these sort of short tales that people tell on birthdays. And then when the baby was born and we would be walking around, especially if it was both of us and the baby, both me and Richard and the baby, people would ask these questions that I initially was sort of shocked by, like, where did you get her, and sort of like, you know,
aisle six,
find
right?
This baby.
Yeah.
They assumed that we adopted, which was not our actual story. There were lots of these questions that at first I thought were really rude, and then I, over time, came to be, I guess, less sleepy and more generous, you know, as the months wore on. And I realized that people were really expressing curiosity, that they really didn't know how these kinds of unusual families came to be, or they knew a little bit, say, about adoption stories, very little about surrogacy. And they knew that there were all these changes happening around them in terms of family structure. They could see it. They can see it on TV if they don't see it in their lives. And they were curious, you know, their question was, I don't know, where's her mother?
Uh-huh.
Things like that. And I thought, well, you know, let me tell them. So that's the genesis of the book. And I told the story of my own kids, and then the coming into being of families around me, people I knew well, so that I could tell them in depth and with intimacy.
Well, let's start back in your childhood. You talked about a girlfriend in school. Tell us about your own awareness about you.
About my gayness?
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's what it sounds like you're asking. And I'm happy to talk about that. I'm not uncomfortable at all with it. You know, I had inklings of being different growing up. Certainly I had, if I were observing me, I would have said that boy's probably going to turn out to be a gay man. But, you know, at the time, I just was me, and I dated women in college, and then after college, I had the sense that there was something more powerful, you know, wanting to be expressed, which was desire for relationships with men. And I guess, let's see, I was 23 when I finally just sort of said, all right, this is what we're doing now. Let's see how it goes. And, you know, that was more or less it. It was just sort of, it fit me at that point, and that was the end of it. And I, you know, I found communities, and I became sort of very empowered in my identity.
And what about family and friends? Was there any pushback? You know, so many times we hear horrific stories about families and friends being not at all accepting or loving.
It was very interesting in my family. And, you know, one of the common things that people say, I think, still probably when their kids are coming out to them is, oh, I'm sad that you're not going to be able to have a family.
Mm.
So it's interesting. That certainly came up out of my parents. And the other interesting thing about my family is that I'm actually a sociologist, not a psychologist, and both my parents are sociologists. And when I said, you know, I'm going to move to graduate school to California, and, you know, very uncomfortably said, and I think I'm going to, I don't know what I said, date men, or they both had a very strong negative reaction. And, you know, these are people that are highly educated, not only that, but think a lot about societies and groups and oppression and so on. And their internal reaction was so strong, they didn't, you know, they didn't have any distance from it. And I'm telling you this because I tell this story in the book too, because they recovered, you know, over time to the point where, you know, we got married on their basically the same spot where they freaked out when I declared that I was gay. So, you know, it all worked out. And, you know, their concerns about us, about me not being able to have a family were clearly misplaced. And this book is, you know, the story of doing that.
Well, you know, for so many folks who I've talked to, families, not only do families, of course, say, well, the first thing that I typically hear that families say is, oh, no, are you sure? And what am I going to say to X, Y, and Z? And then, of course, there are the other responses having to do with religion and having to do with where did I go wrong and having to do with, of course, I was hoping for grandchildren and now that's never going to happen. And so it becomes so painful, you know, just to say, this is who I am and I've decided to be who I am. There are many people who don't have the experience that you had ultimately of having family members who really embraced you, embraced your spouse, and embraced your family.
Absolutely, and it's really, it's tragic. You know, it's just deeply sad that people have so many obstacles to being free. You know, being the person that they feel themselves to be. And that's still the case. You know, I think it's easy at this point for people to look at the changes that have been so dramatic in this area in terms of gay rights and think that, you know, we're done. And people are going to have an experience that is, you know, everyone's going to have an experience that's much easier and they're going to be supported and so on. And that's really not the case. It depends on where you are regionally. It depends on, you know, a lot of family background kind of differences, and even for those of us who sort of made it pretty smoothly through the transition and had family support, you know, I still made decisions about where to have a family,
right,
around other people's prejudices, and, you know, wanting to make sure that we're kind of safe, protected, and, you know, I guess not having to navigate discriminatory attitudes and practices all the time.
Well, and it's unfortunate, as you say, those are things that have to come into your thinking, but reasonably they do. Tell us about your husband, Richard.
Richard, I met in New York in the late 90s, so we've known each other for 16 years now. He's an emergency physician. He's biracial, from his black, white, mixed background from the middle of Pennsylvania. And, you know, I think we both were family people. I think we recognized that in each other when we met. And he's very private, so that's another interesting thing about this experience of writing this book, is watching someone who's very private allow a certain amount of visibility for his own experience as well.
You met in New York. At some point, you made the decision to get to marry, and of course, marriage, not the easiest thing to accomplish for two men. Where did you marry, and what was that like?
Well, Richard, we decided to get married on the Thanksgiving dinner right after the Massachusetts Supreme Court decision legalizing same-sex marriage in that state. And we were able to do that because my family lives there, and we were able to register as part-time residents, basically, to get married there, which was legal. At that time, it was the only state where we could get married. That was 2004. And, you know, it wound up being a very... I thought of myself as a pretty alternative kind of guy most of my growing up, and I was, I think, and, you know, then, you know, I wound up having this big wedding with, you know, lots of sunflowers on every chair, and, you know, the cake with the two grooms in little tuxedos and all of that. It was a beautiful wedding where we combined Jewish tradition, I'm Jewish, and black tradition, in terms, at least in musically. Richard's not religious, but has a very strong, I think, emotional attachment to growing up in church. And, you know, it was a time when, and I'm not sure if this is still the case because I haven't been to a lot of same-sex weddings lately, but it felt like our gay friends who were there were happy for us. You know, they were glad, it was a nice thing. And the straight people there were grateful and more emotional, as though we were giving them something back.
Interesting.
You know, it always interested me. It was like we were recovering some aspects of marriage for them, giving it a new meaning. And that stuck with me for a long time.
Well, that's really interesting, because I think from the outside looking in, would sort of expect the reverse of that the your gay friends would be so much more emotionally connected to the fact that you were actually even able to get married.
In some ways, I think the relationship of at least most of the gay people I know to marriage is more conflicted, because we spent so much of our lives assuming we would be outside of that. We you know, developed the sense of exclusion, and we developed our own alternative traditions and ways of thinking about how to have relationships outside of marriage and what's valuable in non-married life, and, you know, the freedom of not being recorded by the state and not being sort of deep inside of an institution that has all sorts of difficulties and problems in it. So I think, you know, that's probably what was going on with some of my friends was, you know, this is great for you guys. Personally, I'm not sure how I really, you know, whether I want this to be the direction of the movement and so on and so forth. And for the straight people, a lot of whom were married or married and divorced, it was a sort of civil rights victory and, you know, a celebration of civil rights victory and love at the same time.
Well, and I think, you know, just the fact that the two of you were, from what you describe, clearly in love. And, you know, so many times in, I mean, you know, in relationships and weddings, I mean, they happen for reasons that may or may not have to do with love. But you can kind of feel when the parties actually love each other, and that's why they're coming together to marry.
And a couple of things in addition to that, you knew that we had to want it, because you know, this was the result of a long battle by a lot of people, including in social movements, to achieve this possibility, and it was there only in one state. And I think people would start to feel that it was going to turn, and if they did, they were right, as we saw recently in the Supreme Court decision.
Right.
But also, we were grown. You know, we were in our 30s, and it was not a, it was a very clear-eyed ceremony. You know, our friend who officiated knew us well, talked about, you know, sort of the coming together of people who are pretty much fully formed, and not just the beauty of that, but the difficulties of that. And, you know, so I think some of the realness of it was we were like people who had already been through some relationships and, you know, had met each other as grown adults.
Mm. Was there a concern or any difficulties with the interracial aspects of the relationship?
Not that I recall. I mean, there wasn't for me. And, you know, it comes up because any kind of, you know, as you know from your practice, I think any kind of growing up background difference shows up. We have different, you know, ways of thinking about things. We have different ways, even, you know, now of parenting in certain aspects. So it's always come up. It's been maybe a combination of the racial difference and ethnic difference and class difference, growing up with different sorts of different class cultures, different with different resources. So it's not that it was absent exactly, but it sort of pokes its rears its head in certain situations, but wasn't a concern for me or for people around me. And we emphasized it in the wedding. You know, we really were like, this is who I am, and this is who I am.
Okay.
And we celebrated each of us with, you know, we had somebody who was talking about Jewish tradition, and we integrated that in, and we had Richard's sister talking about gospel tradition, and we had my friend Jeannie Tracy, who is a singer that I met when I was writing a book about the disco star Sylvester. She came and sang for us, and we had a cantor. You know, it was very deliberately who we are.
It sounds absolutely delightful. Josh, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to explore the decision that you and Richard made to begin your family and what that was like. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. I'm having a conversation with Professor Joshua Gamson, who is the author of Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. We'll be right back. Hello, folks. This is Pamela Brewer, and you're listening to Men's Monday here on Mind Talk. Joshua, walk us through the decisions or some of the conversations that you and Richard had about actually starting your own family.
So I remember talking about it really early on in our relationship. We used to run together around Central Park in New York, and one of the ways that we would get through the run quickly was by arguing.
Sound really, like an old married
really
couple.
Made the run go fast. And I remember, you know, I don't think it was an argument about having kids, but it coming up already, you know, probably within the first year of what we each wanted, because we were, like I said, we were grown. If we were going to have families, it was going to have to be fairly soon. So we were checking each other out around it. And then it sort of, you know, disappeared for a while we just led our lives. And before we decided to get married, we started to really imagine, what would this be like? What did we each want? I didn't really, you know, it's so complicated. This is one of the things that characterizes all the stories in the book, is that you need so much intention and, right, you know, deliberation when you're missing some of the elements that you need to make a family in the sort of, you know, basically by through heterosexual intercourse. And I was thrown off by commercial surrogacy. There was something about sort of shopping for a womb that, and for eggs, that seemed very uncomfortable for me. And
interrupt you and ask you to explain for those who may not know what commercial surrogacy entails.
Sure, thank you. So in commercial surrogacy, either in traditional surrogacy, a woman is basically paid to carry a child, or is compensated for carrying a child for another couple using her own eggs inseminated by donor sperm or by donor sperm. And in gestational surrogacy, the eggs of one woman are inseminated with the sperm of a donor, fertilized and grown in vitro fertilization process, what used to be called test tube babies, and then implanted into the uterus of another woman. And they're both typically compensated. And in some cases, you can actually, you know, you can sign up with an agency, which is what we did with the second child, and they will help match you with a gestational carrier. And you can also, more or less, shop for eggs online. I mean, you can go to an agency that does that. And I thought that was kind of creepy. And for Richard, it was very important to have some sort of biological connection to a child. I think it's his science background, and also he was very interested in genealogy, and we were tracing his family at the time. For whatever reasons, that was important to him. So we were sort of, how are we going to do this? I would be fine with adoption. It wasn't really what he was looking for. And both of us are people who are going to do, you know, if we decide that this is something we want to do, we're not really asking permission of other people to make big life decisions. We're going to try to figure out what we want, and we're going to try to do it.
Okay.
And I say that with a certain amount of pride. I think that's a good characteristic.
Yeah, indeed.
And we eventually sort of envisioned a version of surrogacy that was more intimate, that did not involve strangers, basically. And right after we did that, I had a dream that my college girlfriend was having a baby. And I called her. I hadn't talked to her in probably, I don't know, a year and a half or something. We were still friends. And I called her and I said, you know, I had this dream. Are you and your husband, you know, something going on? Because there's a slightly mystical side to me. And she said, no, we have enough kids in our lives. And I said, well, do you ever regret it? And I wasn't fishing for this. It hadn't even occurred to me. It was just, I was calling her because I had this dream. And she said, you know, I always kind of wanted to be pregnant and have that experience because I was born into this body, and I want, you know, that's an experience of this body I want to have, but I don't want to raise kids. It's just not what we want to do. And I said, I think I may have a deal for you. And I thought, wow, she'll mull it over? Somebody would do that for us? And, you know, and that was really sort of the beginnings of Reba.
That's kind of extraordinary, isn't it?
Yes, it is extraordinary.
So she mulled it over and came to a decision that seems like it was one that worked well for you and Richard.
Yes, and for her. You know, it got her what she wanted, that experience. What better way to do it than with people that you love and trust? And, you know, she knew she was never going, she did not intend to be a parent, and we intended to be parents. And so our intentions really, really matched. And then it was about finding an egg donor. She was old enough that she didn't want to use her own eggs. It was going to be harder, and she didn't, she was more comfortable with that part of the biological relationship, not her genetic relationship, not being
okay
on her. So that was also something she wanted. So, you know, it worked out very beautifully.
So the egg donor was also someone that you and Richard knew.
Right.
And the sperm donor is between you and Richard.
Right.
And
we know, but it's one of these, you know, one of the things you'll see in the book is that there's sort of things that I do not say.
Right.
And this is one of them. It's an interesting thing about telling family stories in general, but these ones in particular.
All right.
So yes, we know who it is, but and then for the second child, the one who wasn't the sperm donor for Reba is the sperm donor for Maddie, our second child.
Ah, interesting. Okay. How old is Reba today?
Reba's 9 and a half.
And that half is very important at 9 years old.
It is. It is.
And Maddie is how old?
Maddie just turned 6.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Tell us about you talked earlier about the kinds of questions that you would get from people. Tell us more about what would happen between you and Richard as people would ask these, you know, when you think of it, kind of rude, odd questions. But then on the other hand, as you said, you figured out that they were just trying to figure it out. How did that impact you and Richard?
It was short-lived, for one thing. You know, I don't want to exaggerate how long that lasted. There was something about having an infant that really brought that out in people. I don't recall it happening as much with Maddie because we were more obviously parents. We had another kid with us.
Okay.
But, you know, for us it was, I think you'd have to ask Richard how it was for him, but, you know, it was sort of invasive in a way that, you know, I felt like, I knew that this is not a question that a man and a woman walking around with a baby or a woman solo walking around with a baby gets asked. people who are whose skin color, body look doesn't match, isn't the same as their child, do get those kinds of questions,
right,
too, not just us.
Right.
So, you know, it's a signal that people are saying, you know, I'm seeing you as different. What, you know, help me understand. And, you know, at that moment, when your kid's 2 months, 3 months old, you're trying to survive the first months of sleepless nights and being a new parent. And, you know, I didn't want to take on other people's, you know, education.
Completely.
And
makes
so
sense.
I had a bit of an attitude about it. But then, you know, I'll tell you a story that turned it around. Was we were in Santa Fe. I think I had a conference there, and we all went, the three of us. Maddie wasn't born yet. And someone in a gift store asked Richard that kind of question, and he got angry and responded angrily to it. I'm not sure exactly what he said. I kind of half made it up in the book, but, you know, he said something like, why do you always ask that,
mm-hmm,
you know, that kind of response. And she immediately started to cry. And, you know, she was, I then took the baby out because she was crying. And I watched from outside as they were in some sort of intense conversation, and then they ended with a hug. And I said, what happened? And he said, well, she started to cry because, you know, she's recently remarried. She would really like to have a child. She's never had children, and her new husband does not want to already had kids, does not want to go through it again, et cetera, et cetera. She was in a sort of mourning for a part of her life that she couldn't have.
I see.
And her question was about identifying with us. How did you do this thing that is difficult to do? How did you make this family under circumstances that make it difficult, where there are obstacles to it? It wasn't, you know, oh, you're so different, you know.
I see.
I'm so curious about how, you know, tell me your story, because I get to ask stories of anyone who's different than me. And I heard that, and Richard shared the basics of our story with her then as a sort of gift. We weren't giving that gift to most people at that point. And it really shifted me. I said, all right, this is, people aren't always just being rude. They're interested, and there's no reason they shouldn't be interested. And it is interesting. It's interesting, and it's beautiful, and it's difficult. And, you know, there are all kinds of complications from the law and from social stigma and from economic inequality to talk about. And I thought, this is, I'm misunderstanding people's questioning.
And it's also helpful for so many people who thought that a family was not possible.
Absolutely. I think it is helpful for a lot of people.
Talk about a little bit more about your interactions with Tamar. Am I pronouncing her name correctly?
Oh, I'm sorry. Who?
Tamar. You remember is it Tamar? Tamar?
Oh, Tamar.
Tamar. Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Did she have any requirements or stipulations about the baby?
Yes. Tamar is a very thorough person, and I knew that from going to college with her and being close to her then. And you know, she wanted to be compensated, even though she was okay financially. It wasn't sort of a financial request so much as she wanted ways to distance herself from the baby and treat it more like what it was, which is sort of a job or a favor for others, a gift that she was giving to others. And she wanted ways to stay sane about what she was doing, which I think is a pretty common experience for surrogates, that they gain from ways of I don't know, treating it like what it is, marking it as a surrogacy. And she also asked if she could breastfeed the baby, because she knew the science on the advantages of breastfeeding.
Huh.
And it's funny, I had read around a lot. I was, you know, also thorough, so I was reading around on literature on surrogacy and so on. And that's they say, oh, don't let the gestational care carrier attached to the child.
Exactly.
You don't want them breastfeeding and so on. And I said that to her, and Tamar said, I want to be attached to this child, and I hope that's something that you want too. And I said, of course. Yeah, of course. What a beautiful thing. And so when Reba was actually born, we wound up, one of us was always there with her when she was feeding the baby.
Okay.
And it was very, very sweet. And it was a different, part of this book is about expansive notions of kinship and thinking about family and kinship more broadly and more with more fluidity. And, she was saying, I am part of your family. I want to be part of your family. This is going to be my something. I don't know. We don't always have the name for it, but this baby is going to be part of my life forever. And, she was very quickly in the role of Aunt Tamar, and the girls go to her family reunion every summer. So that was already, I think, happening very, very early on, that we were building a more expanded version of family.
And you're right. I mean, it's interesting because I can't think of a piece of literature about surrogacy that doesn't insist that the ties need to be cut. The mother doesn't need to hold the baby, that nothing that would attach the concept of mother to the baby really needs to happen. And certainly breastfeeding would do that.
Yeah. And, we thought about it hard, and we knew we were doing something different from what the literature was, from the people that the literature was advising, basically. And with the second child, it was more like that, more sort of conventional surrogacy. But with the first child, it did make things harder. When we separated, we had lived there waiting for the baby for a few weeks in this house in the country in the winter in Massachusetts. And, of course, childbirth is very intense, and we were all there, and, grandparents and aunts and so on. And, when it came time to say goodbye, it was very hard for all of us. Not for the baby. She was, a week old. But for the adults, it was an extremely emotional scene. We'd been in sort of I called it like a group marriage, because it was Tamar, her husband Andy, and the two of us, and so intense. And, there was attachment, there is attachment, and then there was a moment of detachment, and then there's the rest of your life.
Indeed. What was it like for you when you heard your daughter's heartbeat for the first time?
I don't actually remember the heartbeat. I guess the heartbeat was exciting and relieving, if you're talking about in utero.
Mm-hmm.
I was so relieved. We were so relieved that this had worked. And at the moment of fertilization, it hadn't looked like it was going to work. And so we had all been really devastated. The initial word was that none of the eggs had fertilized when, the in vitro fertilization was happening. And I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe that, we came together. I just had this sense that, like, if you intend so strongly and you act with so much love, how could it not happen? And then the next day they said, all right, we've got, a couple of viable embryos, sort of don't get your hopes up. So when we actually heard a heartbeat, it was, I don't know how to describe that relief. It wasn't just relief that it had worked. It was relief that the universe works in a way that I want it to work, that love and intention can have positive results, even though I'm not naive. I don't think that always happens.
Indeed.
But I was sort of relieved for the universe. And then, seeing her for the first time is the more dramatic, emotional time, when she's there's an actual human being there who is at the very, very beginning of her life. And we did that. We made that. We conceived it. We, with great love and intention.
It's just extraordinary, and I can hear the joy in your voice even as we talk about it now. It's really lovely. We're going to take a break, folks, and when we return, we will continue with Joshua Gamson, author of Modern Families. Don't go away. Joshua, the whole matter of surrogacy, there were so many things that it seemed like you had to think about that from the outside looking in one wouldn't realize required thought. For example, the names on the birth certificate. Walk us through that. Was that a simple matter or no?
No, it wasn't a simple matter in either case for us to be listed as parents. What's so fascinating to me is that the intentions of the parents to be and the intentions of the gestational carrier and the egg donor and anyone attached to them are right out there. It's very clear. Everybody's clear about what they're doing. And, you know, on a deeper level, they're doing something very beautiful. They're intending to bring a life into the world for people who want to be, to love and be loved, mm-hmm. as parents. And the law required in the case of us and Tamar and her husband Andy, then husband, that we sue them for parental rights. Legally speaking, we had to do that. And so that was the format of, you know, in order for them to, they had to relinquish parental rights because they would be the presumed parents in the state that they were in, regardless of our intentions. The state would consider them the parents, and they didn't want that obligation or responsibility or legal status. And then to get on a birth certificate, we had to do various other legal paperwork, basically, and pay lawyers, so it's an additional cost on top of the medical costs that are not covered, and then for Maddie, for our second child, she was born in Kentucky, and we got a pre-birth order from California. So here you can try to get a designation by a family court in your county, saying that you are the intended parents, and so you are to be listed on the birth certificate, and we got that for Maddie, and when we went to Kentucky for a while to await her birth and were working on that, our lawyer here said that Kentucky was refusing to recognize that. And we left the hospital with Maddie with some sort of paperwork that listed no parents. I mean, she was legally parentless at the time we left the hospital, which was a surreal experience.
Indeed.
And had to continue sort of fighting that through lawyers for several months until we received the birth certificate, which was actually listed with Gail, who was the gestational carrier, with her name on it, and then it was sealed and reissued with our names on it. So it was eventually resolved. But again, it was our intentions were very clear, and we were all in agreement, and it was all sort of loving. And then the law was something we had to confront, because the law saw us very differently.
Well, and I think about not only the emotional expense of all of this, but my goodness, the financial expense of all of this sounds like it could rise to, could have risen to daunting numbers, did it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, usually the numbers that people talk about with surrogacy are somewhere between $80,000 and $120,000. That's a lot of money. And, you know, we are a professor and a doctor, and we got help from my parents, even though we were a little old for assistance from parents. You know, they wanted to help. You know, so we had all the advantages to be able to do it. And it's one of the things that I think needs to be looked at more carefully, and that I talk about in the book, is that this kind of family making is so expensive, and there's so little, you know, there's no insurance that covers it. It's not built into public health in any way. That it's become something that only people of means can really do, and that is, how do I put it? Not right.
That's a good way to put it. Let's talk about, just for a moment, one of the other stories that you share, one of the other families that you share in the book. Is there one that you would prefer, or shall I pick one?
You can pick one. I'm curious what you're interested in.
How about Maya and having four co-parents?
Oh, yeah, that is an interesting one. Maya and Priya are the daughters. So they are both adopted. This is Richard's best friend, whom I call Tess in the book, had decided, always knew she wanted to have kids, and was involved with women. Her identity is more complicated than that, but she's in a long-term relationship with a woman, and had originally solicited a sperm donation from a good friend, and that didn't work out. It got to the point where she was, you know, doctors were talking about the poking and prodding and costs and so on, and she just said, "I'm out. This is not the way I have to do this. I don't have to be the carrier of the baby." And so they decided at that point to adopt, and they went back to the man that she had asked to donate sperm and his partner, a male partner, and said, "Are you interested in helping to parent a child that we might adopt?" And they were shocked, because they thought the deal was sperm donor. Mm-hmm. But they both also really wanted to be parents.
Interesting.
And so they had, before they had even begun the adoption search, they had designed a four-parent family, two households, right? So it looks very much in structure like a sort of divorced,
exactly.
Two divorced couples, kind of, or like in a divorce and remarried. But it's without the animosity that sometimes goes along with divorce.
Indeed.
And, you know, that had always been kind of one of my fantasies of a way to make my own family. And they did it, and they wound up adopting. Now, it's complicated. Tess had to adopt as a single woman because of legal restrictions in the countries of origin around who could adopt. She could not say, one, she could not tell the truth about it. She couldn't say, we're trying to make a four-parent family, and so we want to adopt a child and bring them into a household with lesbians, and then we're going to co-parent with a couple of gay men. Most institutions are not at that point yet where they say, yeah, that sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
But again, these are people who want what they want, know that it's good, and are going to make it happen. You know, it's not, they know what side they're on, and so they made it happen, and they adopted a child from Nepal, who was a baby at the time, and then a couple of years later decided they wanted to adopt another child, and adopted a child who was older than their first child, and she was adopted from India. And so their family is four parents, two dads, two moms, and Maya and Priya. And they're sort of my kids' cousins.
And how does that work in school, family outings, parent-teacher's night? How does that work?
I don't really know because, you know, this book is really about the making of the families, and I just sort of witness it when I go visit them. You know, the kids are very equipped to explain, and, you know, I think that it just works matter-of-factly. It's kind of, you know, I assume anyway that it works the way our lives work, where parent-teacher conferences, one of the parents is there with another one of the parents, and if somebody is asking, they explain, and, you know, their friends know that the basics. And they're, you know, they're more of their time is at the mom's house, and then some weekend time with the dads.
Okay.
So it may appear to some people that this is a lesbian mom family, and they don't know that there's two dads as well.
Gotcha. And, you know, it's really interesting that children, if you present children with age appropriately, present them sort of with the facts, then they just kind of accept it and move forward. I know that you share a conversation between yourself and your daughter, and which I think you were at with Min and Max,
mm-hmm.
and your daughter right. wanted to know who was who?
Wanted to know if Min was male or female. I think because Min is trans, so she was rightly, he's a trans man, transgender man, and she was rightly seeing some mix of genders there, and I said, I don't know, you know, maybe a mix, maybe man, maybe woman, you can ask, and, you know, she's used to more gender options than male or female around her, because we live in the Bay Area, and it's, you know, more visible and less apologetic than elsewhere, and so on. And, you know, she just sort of shrugged. You know, it's the way it is with so many things with kids that you have to...
Right.
They observe differences between people. They observe how people treat one another. And, you know, they know their life. My kids know they have two dads and what their life is. And you have to actually sort of teach them, adults have to teach them to make that a bad thing or a good thing or a, you know, or to hate it.
Right. Absolutely. Adults can do lots of things with their children, sometimes unintentionally, but
yes.
Powerful nevertheless. And,
right.
And just the idea that your daughter, I mean, I note that you describe it as she's aware that there are more gender options than just one or two. And
right.
And that's really, I mean, so she grows up, it would seem to me, both of your daughters grow up with a sense of expansiveness and acceptance about human beings that perhaps a lot of children, a lot of adults don't experience.
I think so. I think that is, you know, to be frank, one of the advantages of these kinds of less conventional family forms is that we're living that, and we can talk about it with them, and they can see it. But I also want to say that some of that's institutionalized around here. So they go to an Oakland public school, and there's a gender diversity curriculum in elementary school.
Huh.
So they, you know, they talk about it in school. Again, age appropriate. It's, you know, has to go through the powers that be. I don't know what the process is, but I'm sure it's not an easy one to get something approved as a curriculum, but they have a, you know, gender diversity, family diversity curriculum. It doesn't solve everything. It doesn't stop kids from saying, you know, oh, you've got no mom or whatever kids say, but, you know, it's exposure to a gender spectrum and to a spectrum of family types.
And, you know, I just think that if all of our schools had gender diversity, family diversity, racial diversity, religious diversity kind of programming, then we would have a different world from the one that we have now, which kind of seems to be mad at most people all the time.
I agree, you know, and lots of people disagree with us, so it's a fight. And, you know, it's a fight I'm willing to fight because I know that this is true, that expansive is better than its opposite, and loving is better than its opposite. You know, I know those things. So, you know, I can fight that fight. But I would also say that, you know, one of the ways it happens is that kids growing up with a matter-of-fact sense that people live their lives differently, people come from different backgrounds, and people sometimes treat each other horribly on the basis of those backgrounds and so on. That kind of understanding allows them to imagine their own lives differently, and you wind up, I think, ultimately with people who have more freedom to make decisions around their gender, how they want to live their racial identity, what kind of family they want to make, and then that also fosters social change, positive social change.
When you think about your girls as adults, if you do, what kind of life would you wish for them?
Oh, like every parent, I think I would say, a happy life, you know. I want them to be happy and free.
Gotcha.
And, you know, and well-educated and cultured and all of those things. But, you know, I think more and more as I get older, I think about kindness and freedom. Mm. You know, that those are things I want them to have early on to take with them into adulthood. And we, I think, spend a fair amount of energy in trying to raise kids who are kind and who are thinking about how to be fully themselves and how to be free and how to make conditions for others to be free. You know, not just the child who has achieved.
The way in which you have approached modern families, stories of extraordinary journeys to kinship, it seems to serve many purposes. It seems to certainly be a personal story, but it also seems to be a guide. It seems to be a support system. It seems to be so many things. If you had to put it in a category, would you?
I think of it as sociologically informed storytelling.
Okay.
And, you know, I guess I would put it in a storytelling category because that's really what it is. But the stories that I'm trying to tell, I'm trying to put them in a bigger, I'm trying to show the bigger picture because, you know, if you're going to make families the way we made families and the other people in the book made families, you encounter from the very beginning social inequalities that are some of them in your favor and some of them not in your favor, some of them that are hurting others that you have to think about if you're doing this mindfully and you're doing this responsibly. And so that's part of the storytelling, is the personal story with an eye to the, I guess, really social justice.
And social justice is certainly something that we could all stand to pay lots more attention to and lots more expansive attention to, I would suggest, than we do today. Dr. Joshua Gamson, author of Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship, thank you so much for spending...
Thanks for this great conversation.
Well, it's just been a pleasure talking with you. Is there a website for the book or for you?
For me, it's joshuagamson.com. And you can find, you know, there's a spot there for the book.
And can you spell your name so folks can find you?
Joshua is my first name, Gamson, Gamson. And it's all one, Joshua Gamson Online.
It's Joshua Gamson Online?
No, it's joshuagamson.com.
Sorry. Okay. All right. All righty. Okay. Thank you again so much for joining us today. It's really been a pleasure.
Mine too.
Folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Remember, you can listen to this program or any Mind Talk program on demand at myndtalk.org. The producer is Jim Brown in 26x2 Communications. The assistant to the executive producer is Lede Battle. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. This program is provided as an educational public service and is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a licensed or other professional. And please always, always remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.